I'm Bob Boylan. NPR Music is celebrating 10 years. We're going to do a podcast for every year. And right now, I'm here with Stephen Thompson and Lars Gotrich. It's 2008, everybody. Remember this, guys?
Yeah, just curling up in a fetal position as you speak.
I like the question, does anyone remember this? We played Bon Iver and talked about Bon Iver on All Songs Considered so many times that we joked about starting an Iver jar.
Oh, yeah.
Where every time there were referenced, somebody had to throw in a quarter.
If only.
A tear-streaked quarter.
We would be wealthy.
We would.
At this point, invested
we would.
And so forth.
Should have invested it.
We played this at the beginning of the year in 2008 on All Songs Considered, but the record had come out as an independent record earlier the past summer in 2007, yeah?
Yeah, it got its official release in 2008, and that's when it really broke through and won the hearts and minds of a grateful nation.
And also changed, I think, a lot of the way a lot of people made music. I think a quieter music...
there is a lot more falsetto, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about it. I was looking at the albums that came out in 2008, and among them, in addition to this Bon Iver record, was Fleet Foxes' debut. And you really started to see a rise of kind of indie choir boy music and you know, kind of sensitive beardy dudes with guitars. And a lot of that sound really became very, very popular in 2008.
In March of 2008, we broadcast Bon Iver from South by Southwest. I won't play that concert, though. It's available online here, and you can still listen to it. But after the show, I think it was Robin Hilton and I went to a park across the street and interviewed him and Mike Noyce, and they sat down. I just want to play a clip of that tape, and it gives you perspective. There were two things that were happening. One was Justin Vernon lost his fanny pack, which he said had everything important to him in his entire life.
So passports and stuff that.
But also, this will give you just perspective. It's been 9 years since then. I'll play this. So you start going out and playing? Is that the way it worked?
Yeah, with Mike?
Yeah.
I called him in what was probably December this year, or November, and he was still in college at the point. I was like, look, I need to go on tour starting in January, and I'm going to be really quick and honest about this. You need to drop out of school if you want to do this. I don't know how much money we'll make. I don't know what it'll be, but you'd be perfect for the job. We'll see what happens. And so basically he came back to me the next day. He said, yeah. So we hadn't performed ever together. Our first show was like at the Shuba's Music, it was at the Turf Club in St. Paul in front of 450 people. And I don't think Mike has been in front of that many people performing ever, let alone performing with me. I have to say it was one of the best shows we played, and it was dynamite. And I haven't even stopped to think about it because I'm sort of, this is a good thing. I think I'm numb to sort of universal victory where things work out so much. And I'm so used to being lucky enough to cultivate good luck and everything. And with Mike coming on and the backstory of us playing, it's just like, oh yeah, that's amazing. That's a really cool story. We're here and we're playing. And that's the thing that is like really current and I'm really happy about.
Wow, his voice sounds just like home. We're both from Wisconsin. And I could just live in that accent.
But I also just love the fact that where they're at. I mean, put a band together, get out on tour. You don't know what's going to happen. The guys quit school.
Part of what amazes me about that particular record, and obviously we've got other stuff to talk about, but he could have just made one great record. Lots of bands have one great record in them. But the fact that he, over the course of the next nearly a decade, made two more wildly different records that sound nothing like For Emma Forever Ago, it was the start of a sustained stretch of really excellent music.
Yeah, if he had just gone out and started making a bunch of the things that people imitated him,
right,
then I don't think we'd be talking about him today.
Yeah.
At South by Southwest then, and Stephen and I were there. Lars, you weren't, so you can
I've
sit back
actually
and...
never been to South by Southwest.
Wow.
Yeah. I consider myself lucky.
And I consider myself lucky. I've only gone 10 years, but you've gone, Stephen...
21.
21.
Yeah.
And we went to see an artist we both really cared a lot about. Her name is Laura Gibson. And we bring up this story, and this is Grandpa telling you. We'll tell you this story.
Gather around Grandpa's knee.
I've heard this story so many times.
So the inspiration behind the Tiny Desk concert series was this Laura Gibson concert.
Yeah, Bob and I met up to see her at the, I think it's the Thirsty Nickel.
The Crusty Nickel.
You will say the Crusty Nickel, and then it becomes the Crusty Bucket. Anyway, at this club, and they weren't really equipped to do rock shows. And so Laura Gibson, very, very quiet singer-songrighter. There was like the basketball game was on. Yeah, people were cheering. Like you could not hear her at all. And I leaned over to Bob and said, God, this is, and I'll put, you know, the swear in brackets, ridiculous. Next time she's in D.C., we should just have her play at your desk. And I have been eating lunch off of that idea for nearly 10 years while Bob has done all of the work. It's worked out great.
Before I came to NPR, before radio, I was doing TV, so I grabbed a couple of cameras. I think Franny Kelly was our other camera person
learning how to do camera on the job.
That's it. I pulled out a mono microphone, sat Laura behind at my chair at my desk. I'm going to read from the copy that I quickly wrote there, and it says, "And so begins what we hope will be a reoccurring series at NPR Music, Tiny Desk Concerts."
And we have now done, I believe as of the day we're taping this, 667 Tiny Desk Concerts.
It's insane.
Let's listen to just a tiny bit of Laura Gibson.
Up with the sunrise, you'll be staring out through the window on the day. I'll be another way. King shadow cast on the covers of your bed. Give me another way. King moment shine against the solemn gray. Tell me the season's almost over. I can wait. So go.
You know, you go back to that, if you watch that video, it's extremely rudimentary. We did not know what we were doing at all.
It sounds nice, though.
It sounds nice, but, like, you look at that video and Laura looks awkward, Bob looks awkward, Stephen looks awkward. But
like
it's very
standing in the frame.
Right, but it's extremely endearing. And I remember this because at the time, I literally sat across from Bob's desk. Yeah. And so I had a picture-perfect view of all these concerts until they just started getting so big that I literally would have to leave my desk. Not only because of space, because I actually had to work.
It was that thing.
Yeah, when we kind of conceived the series, I at least thought of it entirely as a forum for quiet singer-songwriters. Because we were doing a concert series from the 930 Club with loud shows, and I was like, well, this is how we'll get our acoustic balladeers. And like, how many like 20-piece marching bands since then have shown up?
Tomorrow, a 16-piece band with a Hammond B3 are coming. will all fit behind the desk. That's been the rule. We actually fit a grand piano there
we
this
did?
Week.
Yeah.
An opera singer today. It's really been a treat of a series for the people who play, who are nervous as hell, everyone.
Yeah.
And for the audience, we said we didn't know what would happen to it, but the email that came in after Laura Gibson to me and to our team were just extraordinary. There was something about it, and I think it sticks. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Lyft, reminding listeners that they could be relaxing in a Lyft ride right now with their eyes closed, listening to Beethoven or whale sounds or a babbling brook or something else relaxing. Lyft provides rides as relaxing as the buttery smooth voice of a public radio announcer because riding is just a more relaxing way to drive. Lyft, it matters how you get there. Download and ride today.
I'm here with Stephen Thompson and Lars Gotrich. We're talking about some memories from 2008, and I'll play this, and Lars, you'll explain. Lars has awoken.
So in 2008, Bandcamp launches. This was in the, not necessarily the aftermath, but like certainly in the realm of like after MySpace had been such a community for online music discovery. Around the same year, SoundCloud also launched, and as did Spotify, originally in Sweden before it became worldwide. This is Speedy Ortiz, a band that I discovered through Bandcamp. Not until 2012, but they're a band that I've loved ever since and have seen several times. And it was because of this platform that I fell in love with this band. In considering like these three different platforms, with Spotify, it was a tech-driven company that dealt directly with record labels and publishers and left the artists out. And in years, there have been several articles basically bemoaning the fact that artists get like 10 cents a year off royalties. With SoundCloud, that was also tech-driven, but was geared initially more towards like DJs and electronic music producers and was singles-driven. Mm-hmm. Bandcamp kind of came at it as like an open playing field. I went on the Wayback Machine to see what Bandcamp looked like in 2008 and 2009, and funnily enough, it hasn't changed that much. The front page is very different because now Bandcamp does a lot of different projects.
Right.
They have an editorial staff. They do a lot of work with record labels and apps directly. They have a weekly podcast. The basic structure of it's still the same. It's still like this nice sleek where, you know, you hit a play button and the whole album's right there and it just skips right on through. And just like a little simple thing that says, add to wish list or I want to buy it.
Right. And even though a band can put their own artwork up on the page and make it their own, it's still consistency, right from page to page to page, right?
Exactly. And the difference, even though this was a company founded by a couple of tech people that just loved music, the impetus was always artist first. And so that meant that the artists could upload whatever they want. They could charge whatever they want, and Bandcamp would get a nominal fee. You could even charge nothing.
Yeah.
And it's been fascinating to see, because of that, like, basically Wild West aspect to Bandcamp, how different communities just kind of map themselves onto it. And so Speedy Ortiz is a good example, because Speedy Ortiz is a band led by Sadie Dupuis, and she just had some songs she was writing and didn't know what to do with them. And you actually can't find that old demo anymore on Bandcamp. She took it off. But I remember buying it in addition to this the Taylor Swift single.
Which
was the name of the song. And she just needed a place to put something.
Yeah.
And there it was. But it also provided not only a place for like indie rock bands to do their thing, but literally anybody else.
Right.
I think there are two other like really big examples real quick, like the video game music community really latched on to this scene. Another one started burgeoning from Bandcamp, just kind of like, wasn't fully formed, it just kind of was like putting their fingers in it. And there was a bunch of people with synths, both digital and analog, and they're making this music that is commonly referred to as synth wave. Basically, think of John Carpenter, think of like the Blade Runner soundtrack, and you kind of get a general idea of what they were going for. You know, one of those artists was a guy from Paris named James Kent, who records under the name Perturbator, who released his debut Terra 404 at the very end of 2012, the same year that Speedy Ortiz also released those first singles.
You want to listen to this Payback Pursuit?
Yeah. We'll be right back. Another thing to think about is that at the time, in 2008, there was really no way to directly support an artist. There were certainly some burgeoning things that were Kickstarter-y at the time, but weren't digitally focused. They weren't places where an artist could just upload their music and you get the money directly. MySpace kind of did that, but the format was clunky and you never really knew where your MP3s were going. With Bandcamp, you could literally choose what kind of audio format you want.
Love that about it.
Yeah. You can get like the really nice MP3s, you can get the FLAC, you can get whatever. You know, if you're a nerd and you want that, you know, lossless stuff, you can get that. If you don't care, you can just get the MP3.
For the same price.
For the same price. And the thing for me as a fan is that it's also one of the few digital platforms that feels like a record collection. That's important to me, just as a fan. I know, like, a lot of people that are a little bit younger than me don't really care about that, you know, kind of in a Spotify world. But, like, to me, to see the things that I have bought, I like it. Yeah. And it's all in one spot. It's like, oh, yeah, I love this thing. It still feels like I'm picking through my records. And it's a nice reminder to go to my wish list, which is probably at like 2,000 and counting. I'll think the things that I still would like to support and buy.
All right, when's Laura's birthday?
But like the cool thing is, it's like it's not only great for fans, but it's been great for labels that like suddenly have like they have signed on like Sub Pop and Discord. You know, labels with incredible discographies are like, yeah, we're all in. And recently, like Drag City, who does not deal with digital music, and ECM Records, like the label for like experimental jazz and new classical music,
super high quality,
and that's a thing that they value. They want you to hear the highest quality version of that music. They are now on Bandcamp. I think it says a lot, and you know, Bandcamp responds in kind.
Cool. That all began in 2008 and continues well through this day. I'm going to do something else from 2008, and you'll have to explain this one, Steve. The build-up to this song took about 40 seconds, which seemed like forever.
Which is appropriate because the build-up to this record actually coming out took 17 years.
And we're talking about
Chinese Democracy by the band Guns N' Roses. Now, I did not pick Chinese Democracy as a thing to talk about because it became an incredibly important piece of music, but because I think it's emblematic of a trend that we've seen a lot in the last 10 years. Chinese Democracy is the follow-up to Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. There was also a covers album after that that we're
right,
not really
nobody cares about.
Nobody cares about that. In 1991, when Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 came out, Guns N' Roses was one of the biggest rock and roll bands in the world. And this album, Chinese Democracy, had been promised for years and years and years. It cost a fortune to make. Band members cycled in and out, and it was constantly kind of promised and delayed and promised and delayed. And when it finally came out near the end of 2008, it kind of landed with a plop. And it sounds so shiny and expensive and blustery and excessive.
Compressed to hell.
And compressed to high hell.
Yeah.
But it was...
Sorry, that little, yeah.
And you know, Axl Rose had just spent this, you know, like a significant fraction of his life putting it together. But if you look at a lot of the albums that... that kind of came out in that spirit. I mean, My Bloody Valentine hadn't put out a record also since 1991. There's a weird theme of 1991. Mm. Pixies put out their first record in 23 years following an album from 1991.
Oh my gosh.
My Bloody Valentine was another one where, like, we were going to get this follow-up record to Loveless year after year after year. And finally, I think in part because of the internet distribution systems, Lars, that you were talking about, My Bloody Valentine was finally able to just, like, put out an album.
They announced it 1 week, and then it came out, like, literally, I think, like, 5 or 7 days later.
Yeah, and a week after that, people were like, oh, yeah, My Bloody Valentine. But if you look at the list, I mean, also in 2008, there was a new Portishead record for the first time in 11 years.
That one holds up, by the
way.
That
is one really
of the great. I want to play some of the, one of the greatest
I was going to mention it at some point.
on the planet, I think. I mean, I've listened to the song almost more than any other song in my library.
You just want to get Guns N' Roses out of your system.
So bad. You can keep talking if you want, but I'm going to cut off your microphones. This is The Rip from Portishead.
The interesting thing around this period of time is that a lot of artists from the 90s, from the 80s, even way back to the 70s, were starting to, like, come back in to the music world that, like, were so important to a lot of people that were now in their 20s and 30s and never had the opportunity to see them. And some of them just came back, did shows, played their classic albums from the back, and they were great. And some, like, really took a risk and made new records like Portishead, like Braid. Braid's reunion album mm-hmm. was fantastic. And then Pavement, who just kept playing like reunion shows. It's interesting being in that culture and economy now because it's a little case-by-case basis because, like, in some cases, they're just trying to make money, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
401k tour.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem with that.
Right.
But some of them genuinely want to figure out how they fit into the new narrative of music right now.
Right.
It's an era in which we are super served as fans. You know, obviously Guns N' Roses is on one end of the spectrum, but you have bands that had like a few thousand fans, but they can come back and super serve those fans. Their fans will know how to find them.
One of the cool things that came out in 2008 was this, I remember the Brian Eno Bloom for the iPad, which to me was revolutionary. You could play music on a tablet. Blew my mind. It was really incredible. I still love that.
The debut album by the cosmic metal band Kralis came out in 2008.
Oh man, I was going to mention Kralis.
Well, that was an extremely important record. Like, I didn't realize it came out in 2008. It was my favorite record that year, and, like, I keep writing about them.
And just like that was the Vampire Weekend record.
Yeah, the Vampire Weekend record came out. Their debut record came out at the beginning of 2008. Beyonce's Single Ladies video, one of the greatest videos of all time, was 2008. A couple of great songs that jumped out at me as just like all-time favorite songs, Fur by Blitzentrapper and Festival by Sigur Rós.
Let's go out on this song by Portishead. This is called Rip. And 2008, awesome year. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.